Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So are you stressed out from the holidays already? Worried about money, work, or family? My next guest might just prescribe a trip to your nearest art museum. Alain de Botton is not a doctor. He's a philosopher who's written about how Proust can change your life and the architecture of happiness, two of his previous works. And he's taken that interest in how interacting with great works of art can make us better people to the museum and gallery now. His new book, co-written with art historian John Armstrong, is Art as Therapy. And he joins me now from London. Alain de Botton, welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello. Thank you so much.
And listeners, we have a slideshow on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show to check out some of the images in the book that we will refer to and how Alain de Botton sees therapeutic value in some of these works of art. So this is going to be fun and interesting to follow along with. If you're by a web connection, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you will see the Alain de Botton segment right there. So first, what do you mean by therapy? Did you mean it to be linked to people's notions of psychotherapy?
I mean it in the loose sense. In other words, not, psychotherapy is in something you might do four times a week. I mean it generally as in helpful. The modern world really struggles with this concept, with this question of what is art for. Explanations are remarkably either thin on the ground or else incredibly complicated. And I advance a very simple theory that, broadly speaking, art should have a therapeutic effect on its viewer. That means it can console, cheer, broaden horizons, increase empathy, calm down, restore hope, any number of maneuvers, but they're all united by this under the umbrella of therapeutic benefit.
And you actually came up with seven functions that art could help with and listed them. They are remembering, hope, sorrow, rebalancing, self-understanding, growth, and appreciation. How did you settle on those?
My co-author and I, we sat around, we were trying really to capture as many of the things that an ordinary, say, museum visitor or someone who's familiar with art might feel in their heart, not necessarily their mind, but in their heart, as they approach some of their favorite works. We were trying to be very intuitive and emotional and direct with the reader and just pick on some of the big reasons why art matters. We were not trying to be abstruse or peculiar. We were just trying to go for the huge reasons why, in a busy world, you might want to bother with art.
So let's look together at the first image in the slideshow. It's Vermeer's Woman in Blue reading. And again, listeners, if you're just tuning in and you want to look at some of these slides along with us as we talk about them with Alain de Botton, author now of Art as Therapy, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. And the first image in the slide is, as you will see, Woman in Blue reading by Vermeer. And you tie that to the remembering function. What do you see in that painting?
It's part of the discussion on why art should matter. And we begin by saying that if we had a perfect memory, if we remembered everything, we wouldn't need art. The impulse to take a picture, to make a drawing, starts from our awareness that we're forgetting everything all the time, and we want to hold on to something. But that's too simple. We don't just want to hold on to anything. We want to hold on to the things that matter. And the people that we call great artists are people who seem able to record in a scene those things that matter most. Now, in any particular view, there are millions of things, literally millions of bits of data and information that you could seize. And when we call an artist great, it's because they seem to have an ability to select from the millions of options, the millions of ways that you could represent a person or a scene, those things that seem psychologically most important. So Vermeer seems a great artist, especially in that painting, because he seems to be getting at something that is fundamental to that woman. We seem to be able to read her character. She comes alive, and what is most important about her is captured, bottled, and, you know, handed down to posterity. And that's what we call a great artist. And you can do this with any great artist. You know, sometimes we find ourselves in a particular moment and we say, oh, that the atmosphere there is a bit like an Edward Hopper painting. And why do we use that word Hopper at that particular moment in the diner, in a particular part of America or whatever? It's because Hopper seems to have put his finger on something that we now see ourselves, because Hopper has given us a pair of glasses that enables us to see it more clearly. And that's what Vermeer does, and any number of great artists have that ability to get us to see what matters from amidst a mass of information.
Now, before we go on to talk about the next slide, which is Manet's Bunch of Asparagus from 1880, I want to get this part out because I think it's so fascinating. You want art museums to be organized around this idea of what we should ask from art. And I see that in April, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam is going to add you and your co-authors' captions to some of their works. So how will they differ from what are on the Rembrandts and Vermeers, for example, now?
I mean, taking a step back, most museums are organized by just about the most stupid and banal way that you could organize a bunch of pictures, and that is by when they were painted. And that is a banal way because imagine it with your bookshelf. Imagine if you'd arranged your books by when they were written. Of course, that tells you something, but it's a very pedestrian way of organizing images. We were inspired by the way that religious institutions organize spaces. And what they do is they say, okay, we're going to organize a space according to certain of the problems and issues that might be afflicting the person who walks into this space. So a church is a kind of giant machine for trying to persuade you to live like Jesus. I'm summarizing brutally, but that's basically what it's about. In other words, it has a theological goal. Art is in the service of theology. We're suggesting that art should nowadays be in the service of psychology, the psyche of the individual secular human. And for this, we need to rearrange how museums are done. And so we're suggesting that rooms are grouped together, works of art, according to the central dilemmas and pains and troubles and joys of the human spirit. And that means love, it means death, it means family, it means children, it means work, all the things. And I happened to be laying out this theory in a lecture some months ago when someone came up to me at the end and said, introduced himself as the head of the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. And he said, well, you've spent about the last 50 minutes trying to tell me why my job is useless. And I said, well, not quite, but, he had a smile on his face. And he said, look, I find it interesting. Come and see me. So I went to see him, and he basically said to me, take the museum and do what you want with it. So for six months, we're turning the museum upside down. We're rehanging the collection and recaptioning it and organizing rooms by themes. So we will have a whole gallery devoted to the theme of love, et cetera, et cetera. I won't give it all away, but essentially we're going to rearrange the museum according to psychological rather than art historical categories.
And I'll give some more of it away. One of them is love, as you say. Another is fear. Another is compassion. Another gallery would be of self-knowledge and one of suffering. So to get back to the slideshow, the second image in the slideshow that we've culled from your book, Manet's Bunch of Asparagus, this, you say, goes on the love floor?
Yes, absolutely. That could sit happily there. The thing about it is it's a beautiful painting of a very ordinary thing, which is a bunch of asparagus. And before the artist looked with fresh eyes at them, no one had really paid them much attention. And this is a key maneuver that artists do. They look at bits of the world that we think are boring, banal, that we know all about, and by bringing to this object or to a scene their particular intelligence and sensitivity, they bring it to life and they make us see that what we'd previously described as banal and humdrum actually has richness and interest. And whether it's, Jasper Johns doing his magic with a set of cans of beer, or Andy Warhol getting us to look again at certain aspects of the world, or whether it's, Fra Angelico getting us to look at the clouds in the sky, all artists are engaged in what you could call redirecting and re-energizing our interest in the world around us. And that is a fundamental and highly useful category. And now, coming back to love, this is very connected to love, because love is appreciation. When we use that word about a relationship, when you say you love somebody, you are alive to what is special about them. And the suggestion is that we learn to do a little bit with our partners, particularly if we're in long-term relationships, we learn to do a little bit of the same maneuver as Manet performed on the asparagus. In other words, seeing or remembering the extraordinary in what has come to seem unfairly ordinary.
And it's not just old masters that you look to. The third image in the slideshow, for people following along on our site, is a series of photographs of water towers, and that's the name of the series, Water Towers, by Birnbecker and Hillebecker, a very familiar sight to New Yorker, these water towers. What should we ask of that image?
Well, you know, those images are classics of 20th century art, in that what they're doing is saying there's this category called artistic, and we tend to assume that artistic means beautiful and pretty in a kind of classic, rolling meadows in France, or a beautiful English landscape, or something like this. And the Beschers were doing this rather intriguing thing, which was to say, hang on a minute, the category of the beautiful and the interesting actually contains, if we're fair about this, a whole lot of objects which artists have never considered before. Who'd ever thought of looking twice at a water tower? Now, actually, water towers do have fascinating and intriguing aesthetic properties, but we miss them normally. And the Beschers, like so many artists, are saying, hang on, there's something of value here. Look at them a certain way. They're beautiful. They have an elegance, a formality. They sit stoutly on the earth, and yet at the same time soar upwards, etc. And it's just a gentle reminder of value lies more promiscuously scattered around the earth than we might think it does.
My guest for another few minutes is the philosopher Alain de Botton. You may know his previous books like How Proust Can Change Your Life and The Architecture of Happiness. His new book, co-written with art historian John Armstrong, is Art as Therapy, and you've been hearing his proposal for a new way to organize art museums around themes like love and fear and compassion and self-knowledge and suffering, rather than in art historical themes. I'm going to take one phone call of pushback for you, and it comes from Julie in Katona. Julie, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. I just wanted to say, as an artist, I think that this, what I'm hearing, sounds very narcissistic to me, because I think it's really dangerous to think that, you just pull the art, from an artist, what an artist is creating, that it has to go back to what each individual, it's like about me, and it's not about me at all. Art, it's art is art. You can't explain it like that. And I just think that to try to, fit it into the way that this person is describing. I mean, he's knowledgeable in a lot of ways, I'm sure, but I, as an artist, I completely disagree and think that it leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And narcissism is what comes to my mind. Like, it has to be about me, about the person, the art. And I just disagree with that.
Alain, do you want to engage with Julie?
Sure. Look, narcissism is never a pleasant thing, but I think there's a real difference between having an intimate emotional connection with a work of art and selfishness or narcissism. The two are absolutely different. You can have a beautifully intimate relationship with a piece of music or a painting and not be a selfish person. So I think that's to imply a kind of moral category which doesn't fit. I think that works of art are uniquely well placed to offer us reminders of all sorts of things that slip too readily from our minds. For example, one of the things that works of art do so well is take us into the lives of others. They stretch our horizons. So far from making us narrow or selfish, they induct us into some of the mysteries, charms, horrors, beauties of lands far away, people we haven't considered, etc. And museums and other cultural institutions that present art to us should make it available, make it possible for us to kind of be a little bit more direct about what we're doing when we come into contact with works of art. We are basically working on ourselves. We're making ourselves slightly better people through connections with works of art that help us to grow, to mature, to rebalance ourselves. And I think it's this aspect of art that is too often neglected from the narrative we're given by museums about why art matters. Art, at the end of the day, matters because it is a tool of, in the broadest and deepest sense, self-development.
Convinced at all, Julie?
I'm not. In fact, I'm even just more validated. You're saying things like art's a tool. It's not a, you know, like and the person is, all people are interested in improving themselves, and you know, and those kinds of things are just not true. Not everybody fits into that mold, and if you're an artist, you're not thinking about those kinds of things. I think anyway, the great artist or any artist, you know, you're creating something. And so I just disagree. That's all.
Right.
You know, coming.
Yep.
That's all. But thank you. I appreciate it.
And thank you very much. And if you want to say one more thing to her comments, you can, or we'll go on and look at one more slide before we run out of time.
Yeah, I think, you know, let's head on to the slides.
And because it's almost the opposite of some of what you were saying just a moment ago. You also do want to defend prettiness. I think you used that word that way, prettiness in art. And that's part of what the fourth image in the slideshow, one of Monet's water lilies. What do we ask of that painting? Is pretty still enough?
Well, it's interesting because the word pretty sets off real alarm bells in elite culture. That Monet is the most popular image in the National Gallery in London. It's the best-selling image. And that really worries people because there's a kind of idea that prettiness is a little bit suspect because it's close to sentimentality, it's childish, you know, and there's a kind of assumption that the best kind of art is dark and is somber, etc. And, you know, the point we're making is if this kind of art is really popular, flowers in spring, children gambling through meadows, you know, beautiful skies, etc., there are some good reasons. Most of us are not about to forget how awful the world is. In other words, we are not in danger of becoming sentimental. What we're really in danger of is clinical depression, despair, giving up on the human race and the human project. And the reason why pretty postcards and pretty things are perennially popular is because they are emblems of hope. And our longing for hope and the way that we find hope in art, in that category known as the pretty, is nothing to be scoffed at or ignored. It is actually part of a very natural and very healthy impulse to rebalance some of the obvious horrors of the world with evidence of its finer and, you know, nobler moments. So we're just making a case there for getting elite culture not to feel so queasy about popular taste in the pretty. You know, the pretty can be serious and has a real role to play.
Do you have an agenda at all for artists to change the way they make art, in addition to museums changing the way the works are organized and captioned?
No, my problem is not at all with what work artists are making, merely with the way that art is framed and arranged. And it's what we're doing is trying to invite people to treat art in the same way that people naturally treat music. People are very good at using music and matching music to their own states of mind and states of the soul. That's how people create playlists, etc. People naturally have a very direct, easy relationship to music. I think one should be having this kind of relationship with art, but we tend to get very nervous. We wonder when it was painted. We wonder what we should know. We kind of fall into a solemn trance in museums. We get inhibited. And our book is an invitation to relax and engage with art in a way that it can really interlock with some of our deepest problems rather than being some kind of abstract thing that we take in out of a kind of duty and remain slightly confused by.
Well, the book is called Art as Therapy. It includes many prints, including some of the ones we've been talking about that we culled from the book for the slideshow, the Vermeer and the Monet and a whole bunch of others. And there's a website related to the book and a smartphone app. People can search Art as Therapy. Have you thought of doing those audio tours for the Frick or the Tate or something like that? You could go around the curators that way.
Yes. We may do that, and we're very happy. You mentioned the app. We've got this little microsite app, which is free at artisttherapy.com, and that's had a huge success. It's gone around the world. It's had a million hits, and it really captures what we're trying to do, which is to match images to states of mind. And you know, I'd urge all your listeners to take a little look at artisttherapy.com.
Alain de Botton is the author with John Armstrong. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Southern Pine Beetle invades New Jersey. Stay tuned.